You're listening to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. The U.S. Supreme Court term that began last week has the potential to make significant and maybe even historic changes in law. The court has undergone major changes in the last few years. Former President Donald Trump appointed three justices to the court who are considered conservative jurists. Considering the justices don't always come down on cases in a predictable way, it is generally viewed that conservatives have a 6-3 majority on the court. The philosophical makeup of the court for a full term has left some predicting that there could be major changes in law. The court could make decisions this term on abortion, gun rights, and the death penalty. To preview the term, we're joined by two law scholars today, Michael R. Domino, professor of law at Widener University Commonwealth Law School, and Dr. Michael Moreland, professor of law and religion and director of the Eleanor H. McMullen Center for Law, Religion, and Public Policy with the Villanova University School of Law. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Before we get to the cases before the court, I want to discuss something that we've heard much more about in recent weeks, and that is the shadow docket. Dr. Moreland, what is the shadow docket?
Well, it's a term that some legal scholars came up with to designate the way in which sometimes the court decides cases on emergency appeals. And so these are cases that come up in a posture that is different from the normal case we hear usually about where, you know, there's full briefing and oral argument over several months at the culmination of litigation. And so these are cases that come up in an emergency posture. I'm not sure that shadow docket's really fair. I mean, it's not like they're doing it secretly or anything like that. I mean, the orders are available publicly on the Supreme Court's website, but it does mean that these some of these cases, including some of the COVID issues that have come up and issues about the Texas abortion law, most prominently a few weeks ago, came up again in this kind of emergency posture. And so that's what people are talking about when they talk about the shadow docket usually.
So you mentioned that it's supposed to be used in an emergency situation. How is an emergency situation defined?
Well, it's when the lower courts usually have decided to, for example, allow a law to go into effect or to block a law from going into effect. And so the litigants who've lost below in the circuit courts of appeal or the state Supreme Courts rush to the U.S. Supreme Court and ask the Supreme Court to give them some relief. And so that's why it creates an emergency, because usually people either want something to be blocked or want something to go forward. And the U.S. Supreme Court's their last chance to do that.
There was a story on NPR last week that pointed out that this court has used it more often. I say this court, meaning over the past few years, has used it much more often, like twice as much in the 10 years previous. Why is that?
Well, I think what sometimes happens is that judges in the lower courts make decisions that are frustrating to one side or the other. And so I think people are more willing to rush to the Supreme Court, thinking that the Supreme Court will give them what they're looking for, one way or the other. And again, we're used to this in some contexts. The death penalty, for example, very prominently has been a place where we've had emergency appeals for decades now, you know, the eve of an execution, the Supreme Court being called on to decide on an issue. But now we've seen it happen in some other settings as well.
Mm-hmm. Professor Domino, in the case of Texas's so-called heartbeat law, an abortion couldn't be performed after a heartbeat is detected. That's usually at about 6 weeks of pregnancy, and it's pointed out that some women don't know they're pregnant at that point. The Supreme Court used, and I'm going to use the term again, shadow docket, that allowed the law to take effect. There was some controversy about why they used that as an emergency for an abortion case. Any explanation?
Sure, and thank you for having me on. It's nice to be here again, Scott. I'll just add to what Michael said. The shadow docket, as it's called, is not really something that the court always uses as a deliberative kind of matter. That the Supreme Court is presented with an issue that needs to be decided before the several months or a year that it takes to decide cases normally. So in the particulars of that case, the Supreme Court had to decide whether to block that law from going into effect. Well, the decision to block a law immediately obviously can't be deferred for the usual appellate litigation process, which will take a considerable amount of time. And so it really wasn't a decision on the Supreme Court to use the shadow docket. It's a request for a stay to block a law from going into effect. So it had to be done that way. And the decision of the court, the reason that the court decided the case the way that it did, was because the particular procedural aspects of the law made it very uncertain who could be enjoined from enforcing the law, since that abortion restriction was not enforced by the typical law enforcement mechanism of the state. It wasn't clear who you'd enjoin, who you would block, who would be the defendant in the court order who would be told you can't enforce this law. If the law is not being enforced by an attorney general or a district attorney or even the governor of the state, you can't then say to those people, you can't enforce the law, because they'd respond, well, we weren't going to do it anyway.
So did the court, by not hearing the case and allowing it to take effect, in your opinion, did they act properly?
I'm not sure. I think that there, as a formal matter, there were certain difficulties with taking the action that Texas wanted. There would have been difficulties with enjoining it, but certainly the court has made practical exceptions to those kinds of formal concerns before. And the law of federal courts, the law of injunctions when constitutional rights are at issue, has for more than 100 years not really been that formal, that the court has deviated from what would normally be formal rules in order to protect constitutional rights. And I think it could have done that here, although none of the court's previous cases matched exactly the pattern that would have been required in this one.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Moreland, your thoughts on that? Did the court act properly?
Yeah, I think that Professor DeVino's right. It was a hard case. I mean, to get into the technical weeds, we'd start losing listeners very quickly. It's a very, very complicated issue about, you know, what the powers of federal courts are. Normally, as Professor DeVino said, a federal court enjoins someone from doing something. Normally, you know, an executive authority of a state or a district attorney or an attorney general of a state from enforcing a law. And the highly peculiar thing about the Texas law was that it wasn't enforced by the state. It was enforced by the prospect of people being able to bring these individual lawsuits. And so that's what the five justices in the majority implied in how they ruled, was that there's really no one to enjoin here and now, because the people in front of them in that emergency appeal weren't going to be the ones enforcing them. I mean, there's a state judge and one state clerk, but there are hundreds of judges in the state of Texas. So that was the kind of peculiar technicality of the Texas law, which looks like it might be headed again for another kind of showdown. But I think it really did turn on some very difficult and thorny questions of the powers of federal courts.
If I can give a kind of analogy, it's somewhat similar to libel laws. As you know, some libel lawsuits brought by private parties can implicate First Amendment values. But libel laws, aside from the very small category of criminal libel laws, are enforced by private lawsuits. The Supreme Court doesn't strike down a libel law, at least it didn't in the major case establishing the principle. Instead, it waited for a lawsuit between some private plaintiff and the New York Times. And then in the context of that actual case, it said these libel laws violate the First Amendment. And the Supreme Court in this shadow docket case that you mentioned seemed to indicate that it would be more comfortable deciding the merits of the abortion claim in a procedural context that was more on a par with what they had done in that other area of the law in the past.
Professor DiMino, I'm glad you tried to make an analogy because I was going to ask you to do that. But just so our audience has some context, I mean, it has been, and I don't know whether the legislators who wrote this legislation have said this, but that, you know, there have been accusations or people pointing out that this law was written in a way so that courts couldn't do what they normally do, hold someone or someone accountable or be able to order a stay. In this case, it would allow people to sue those who have performed or aided in an abortion, even if that person suing has nothing to do with an abortion. That sounds very unusual, Professor DiMino. I mean, is that something that we've seen before where the public is? I mean, one thing I did think of is here in Pennsylvania, where there were laws proposed when it came to gun ownership, and that, you know, that there could be those who could had nothing to do with the case could sue a municipality for their gun laws, that kind of thing. Is there precedent for this?
No, nobody seems to have found something that was exactly like this. And that itself is one of the reasons, perhaps it's the best reason, that the Supreme Court refused to block this law a couple of months ago when it came up. If the Supreme Court had considered a case that was exactly like this, then it would have followed that precedent and it would have knew what its powers were. The fact that this was so new is itself a reason not to decide the case on this kind of short-circuited process. The Supreme Court's usual pattern is to get briefing, hear an oral argument, deliberate on the case for a period of months to try to issue a decision that is justified by extensive amounts of reasoning. And if you're going to decide the case on an emergency appeal in a matter of at most weeks, then you're not going to be able to get that kind of deliberation and you're not going to articulate the kind of reasons that establish law in a Supreme Court opinion that will be precedent for lower courts decades into the future. Mm.
So this could be a historic case. Now, we're going to be talking about an abortion case in Mississippi a little bit later, but what you're saying is that this could be a precedent-setting case.
No, I doubt that. I think my point is somewhat the opposite, that the Supreme Court, by taking this case or by refusing to act, by not doing anything and saying we're not going to get involved now, is making an attempt not to make a pronouncement about the law one way or the other. If they had blocked the law, then they would have had to come up with a reason for doing that. But what they did is decided to do nothing. And when they decide to do nothing, they don't have to establish precedent about doing that.
I guess what I was hinting at is that if they did take the case on again, you know, there was a Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals over the weekend that reinstated the law in Texas, that if the Supreme Court were to make a ruling on the case again and use that deliberative process that they normally use, that would establish a precedent.
Yes, that certainly is possible.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Moreland, we have a question from Elizabeth, a listener in Carlisle, wants to know, couldn't the Supreme Court have blocked this ruling, blocked the Texas law, just based on the fact that the new law threatens too much an already acquired right to an abortion?
Well, the question again goes back to who would be in stop from doing what? Under the Texas law, which goes to the point that it's such a peculiar provision that it doesn't empower the state to do anything or state actors, but instead all of these private plaintiffs. And so now that we have a case that's now percolating in the lower courts, we have a case that's a little more squarely presenting that issue than we did before, when it was all kind of prospective litigation about that. But right, I mean, the defense of doctors or clinics who want to perform abortions, notwithstanding the Texas law, is that it's a recognized constitutional right under Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey, and that constitutional defense should mean they should prevail. And we'll see what the lower courts and the Supreme Court might do with that.
Mm-hmm. I want to get into some of the cases that the court may decide, or the court will hear during this term. Dr. Moreland, what makes this Supreme Court term so significant?
Well, there are a number of cases that pose some of the high-profile issues that we've all come to be familiar with as being kind of the blockbuster Supreme Court docket. I mean, I should hasten to add there are a lot of cases that will fly under the radar that are the bread and butter of what the Supreme Court is called on to resolve. 90% or so of the cases are those involving very technical issues of the operation of federal statutes and things like that. But there are some cases involving gun rights, concealed carry permitting. We already mentioned a little bit that there, besides the Texas law, there's this very important Mississippi case involving a post 15-week abortion prohibition, some cases involving law and religion and the issues about restricting the ability of tuition assistance programs to go to religious schools. So on all of those fronts, you've got some very important rulings coming down on guns, abortion, religious school funding, issues that will garner a lot of attention.
Professor Domino, who decides what a significant case is? Or how is it decided?
Yeah, well, the public does, I suppose. but it has the label of being a significant case has no significance. So it's a kind of informal term. It's if you decide to put it on your show, if newspapers decide to put it on their front page, then it's a significant case as far as the public's concerned. If you're a lawyer or a litigant presenting a case that involves an issue involving any Supreme Court case, then that one becomes significant to you. But there's really no difference in terms of the law for any kind of case that's labeled as significant or not. It's mostly an indication of how much publicity a case is going to get.
Well, and publicity is often determined by some of what the hot button issues are. I mean, let's face it, we're talking about abortion. We're talking about gun rights. I mean, those are two of the hot button issues whenever they come up, whenever the Supreme Court is asked to decide a case in those areas. But I'm glad to hear you say that if, on my show, they decide to we decide to talk about it, becomes a significant case.
You hold all the power.
Let's take a phone call from Jackie in Harrisburg. Jackie, you're on Smart Talk.
Oh, thank you. Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, go right ahead.
Oh, great. Hi, I was thinking for the Texas law in particular, using insurance, the ideas behind insurance, you have to have an insurable interest in order to be able to make a claim or collect on a policy. Or something, you know, similar to that. And I was wondering, could that concept be used to fight this law? Because here you're going to have complete strangers bringing lawsuits and trying to collect money on perhaps complete strangers who are, you know, coming in to try to help people get abortions. And it just dawned on me that they have absolutely no business turning in, you know, basically vigilante complete strangers. What do you think about that idea?
Dr. Borland, what do you think of that?
Well, it's a good question, and it goes to what we call in the law the issue of standing, which means what kinds of plaintiffs can bring what kinds of claims in court. And normally to bring a claim, you have to show that you have a legally recognizable interest or an injury. And one of the peculiar aspects of the Texas law, as the caller says, is that it allows people who have very remote or essentially no connection to an abortion to bring these kinds of claims. And so it will depend on some technical issues about, will Texas state courts allow plaintiffs to bring those kinds of claims? Will they allow them to have standing, which they probably wouldn't have in federal court, because there are a lot of federal cases about, for in the environmental law context, for example, some of those statutes allow people to bring claims, but the Supreme Court sometimes has cut back on the ability of people to do that, saying if you don't have a cognizable injury, you can't show up in federal court. And so it'll depend on whether the Texas state courts will kind of relax those requirements and allow people, because of the way the legislature wrote the statute, to bring those kinds of issues in front of Texas judges.
So, and I, you know, we've often heard about courts throwing a case out, refusing to hear it, or deciding against, you know, the plaintiffs because they did not have standing. Is that something, and you said the state courts may decide that, but is that something that the Supreme Court could be asked to decide?
Well, it again, if it's a issue of Texas state law and whether the Texas state legislature can create standing on the part of plaintiffs to bring these lawsuits, that ordinarily would be something that the Texas Supreme Court would have the final say on. But then it gets into some very, again, technical issues about if there are federal challenges like the one that we have right now, that's that the over the weekend, for example, the Fifth Circuit weighed in on. If you have federal challenges like that in a case brought by the United States, where there it would be some different standing rules, where the Department of Justice is the effectively the plaintiff, what would the what kind of implications would be there for that?
Professor Domino, I just thought of this question as Dr. Moreland was answering that question. Sometimes attorneys general in a state are asked to defend a state's law. And sometimes an attorney general will say, nope, I'm not going to do that. Sometimes it seems like there are politics involved. How is it decided, or how can it be decided, whether an attorney general will defend a state's law?
That's an issue that comes up on the federal level, too. There have been significant instances when the attorney general of the United States or the solicitor general of the United States declines to defend a law. And there are generally two reasons why the government official will decide not to defend a law. Number one, if the law is alleged to be an unconstitutional restriction on the executive's powers. So the attorney general or the solicitor general who is in the executive branch will not defend a law that increases Congress's power at the expense of the executive. The second example is if the law that's supposed to be defended is so clearly unconstitutional that there is no reasonable defense of it, then the government branch can decline to enforce the law. But usually the attorney general, the solicitor general will defend a law, even if that person or that agency believes the law is unconstitutional, as long as there's a reasonable argument in its defense. But you are correct that there are some times where there would appear to be reasonable defenses, but a solicitor general or an attorney general will decline to defend the law because of political concerns. Sometimes that's out of the attorney general's own political concerns in areas, states where the attorney general is separately elected. Other times it's the concerns of the administration that has appointed the attorney general or the solicitor general. But that's rare. It's very rare for it to be a purely political decision. Most of the time, the government agency will defend all of the government's laws as long as a reasonable argument can be made in its defense.
Hmm. All right. I want to move on to several of the cases that will be before the court. And Professor Domino, I'll put this one to you first. We mentioned Mississippi a couple times. The case that the Supreme Court will make a decision on is Mississippi's ban on most abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy, 15 weeks of pregnancy, that threatens to topple the court's 1973 Roe versus Wade decision that established a constitutional right to abortion, and a ruling in 1992, that is Casey versus Planned Parenthood, that, yes, that is Governor Bob Casey, former governor of Pennsylvania, that governs when a state may regulate that right. So tell us why this case is so significant.
This, I think, is the most significant case of the term. It's certainly the one that's most likely to show up in the newspapers and on your show, because it's the hardest for the Supreme Court to avoid taking a stand on the validity of Roe and Casey. That the Mississippi law is pretty clearly unconstitutional under the currently governing Casey standard. Casey says the rule from Planned Parenthood versus Casey is that states may not impose undue burdens on women seeking abortions of non-viable fetuses. Well, 15 weeks is before the point of viability. Everybody seems to concede that. And therefore, this law is flatly inconsistent with the Casey standard. If this case, if this Mississippi law is upheld, then it will must be because the Casey standard has been modified. Now, the Supreme Court could come up with a rule that allows the Mississippi law to continue in effect or to have effect without completely overturning the Casey rule or completely overruling Roe and say, now you don't have a constitutional right to an abortion. But if the Mississippi law stands, then the Casey standard for determining which abortion laws are constitutional will have to change. We can't use that viability line anymore because the Mississippi law establishes an earlier line.
Okay, now I'm going to go back to precedent. Casey and Roe established precedent. What would have changed other than the makeup of the court?
Well, nothing. But that's true in several cases, that the every time a precedent is overruled, there's always an argument on stare decisis for keeping the law as it is. But the Supreme Court has said throughout a variety of law, especially in constitutional law, that we have to be able to correct some of our mistakes or they would never be corrected. So if we could never change our precedent, we'd still be stuck with Plessy versus Ferguson. We'd still be stuck with precedents that we don't like. So there have to be some examples where we decided a case, we decided it wrongly. Now we're going to change our decision and put it on the right track. And some justices clearly believe that Roe and Casey were wrongly decided when they came out in 1973 and 1992. So if you require some special justification to overrule a precedent, I'm not sure that it's here, unless you count some justices' belief that Roe and Casey were judicial power grabs, that the Constitution says nothing directly about abortion, and therefore the decisions were not only wrong, but in the view of some justices, they are so wrong as to overturn the usual presumption in favor of maintaining precedent.
Mm-hmm. And just for context's sake, Plessy versus Ferguson is what?
Plessy versus Ferguson is the case from 1896 establishing the separate but equal doctrine that was overturned in Brown versus Board of Education and a series of other race-related cases right. In the 50s and 60s.
Just wanted to provide that context for the historical context for our listeners. Dr. Moreland, your thoughts on this?
I agree. I think this is the case that will certainly garner the most attention over the next several months. The oral argument is set for early December. I don't think there is a clear way that the court could uphold the Mississippi statute and not eviscerate or do away with most of the core holding of Roe and Casey. But look, I mean, this has been something that conservative presidential candidates, Republican presidential candidates, Senate candidates have talked about for 50 years is appointing justices who thought, recognized that the Roe-Casey regime was all being sort of held together with scotch tape and twine because it's kind of a shifting standard and it turns the Supreme Court into this kind of national review board of abortion regulation and that the 14th Amendment doesn't speak one way or the other to the status of the right to an abortion and that should have been left to the political process and compromise and give and take in the first place, as it has been, for example, in Europe, where for the most part, there isn't the kind of hostility around this issue that that we have in the United States. And so we'll see. But I think that it's likely that the Mississippi statute will be upheld. But the reasoning and the extent to which the route to going there means that Roe and Casey themselves have been overruled, I think, is all yet to be seen.
You say you think it's likely that it will be upheld.
I do.
Yes. Because of the makeup of the court?
Yes. And I think that, you know, other than the Chief Justice voted recently in the Louisiana case to, on the basis of stare decisis, to uphold an, or just rather strike down an abortion restriction, which was the first time he had voted in that way, because they basically had were confronted with the same issue they'd confronted a few years earlier. But I think the rest of the justices on that side of the court have shown pretty consistently a view that they don't think that the 14th Amendment protects a fundamental right to abortion, that this should be returned to the states and to the political process, and that that would be better for the country and better for the court. Obviously, this is an issue that people feel very passionately and deeply about, but I think that's what where at least a majority of the justices on the court are.
14th Amendment, what would it say? I mean, Roe versus Wade was decided on the basis of privacy.
Right, that the due process provision of the 14th Amendment protects certain fundamental liberties. That's widely accepted, but the extent to which it extends to things like abortion that were pretty far from the minds of the drafters and ratifiers of the 14th Amendment, that's what people have been arguing about ever since Roe was decided. And I should say some prior cases back into the 1960s as well that Roe relied on for this right to privacy.
Now, when, say, the Mississippi case is upheld, does that mean that abortion would be illegal after 15 weeks nationwide, or would state by state have to come up with their own laws?
No, and I think this is important because there is, I think, sometimes a misunderstanding that if the court were to, say, substantially narrow or reverse Roe and Casey, that that we would suddenly have a regime in which abortion were illegal everywhere. It would be left to the political process of the states as it was before 1973. And so different states will come to different conclusions. Some states, in fact, preemptively over the last several years, New York, Illinois, some other states notably have enacted statutes that are quite permissive about abortion. Obviously, many states have laws like the Mississippi law that's being challenged here that are more restrictive. So it would be left up to the political process, and it would not impose a kind of nationwide solution one way or the other, which I think shows up in the polling. When you ask people, do they support Roe versus Wade? And they say yes, because I think often, and it's hard to know sometimes in polling results, but I think they think that if Roe were reversed, then abortion would suddenly become illegal under every circumstance. Of course, the fact is that it would instead be left to the political process in each of the states. And then when you poll people about, do they favor certain restrictions, say post-viability or in other kinds of contexts, there tends to be more support and even more support in certain parts of the country. And so I think a kind of federalist solution to this is what would emerge from that kind of outcome.
So, Professor Domino, if the Mississippi law is upheld, but a state decides that they're not going to change their abortion law, wouldn't someone take that case to court since the Supreme Court has established a precedent again?
Well, it always depends on what the precedent says, but and it's sort of natural, I guess, for people to think that, well, Roe versus Wade established a constitutional right to abortion and said that people have the ability to have an abortion. So if we reverse that, doesn't that mean that people no longer have the right to abortion? But that's not quite right. That what Roe and Casey said is that in some instances, the states may not ban abortion. So reversing that would say that states may ban abortion and that it would be up to them. So if a state like New York or Illinois decides we're going to allow abortions whenever the woman wants one, regardless of what the Supreme Court says, well, that's going to continue to be fine in those states, because there's no way that the Supreme Court is going to interpret the Constitution to mandate bans on abortion. That simply is not a plausible reading of the Constitution.
So there is, and I know I'm speculating a lot here, but it's been suggested by Dr. Moreland that the court will uphold the Mississippi law. So I am speculating here. So what you're saying, Professor Domino, is that if a woman living in one state that has banned abortion, in essence, can travel to another state to get an abortion if that other state has its own law.
That would likely be the case. Almost certainly would be the case that they could do that the same way that that if one state wants to allow people to drink alcohol at a certain age and another state chooses a different age, that you can travel into the other state and drink alcohol if you're underage in the first state. It's just that's the way our federalist system works, that if you have you allow the states to have different rules, you're going to allow people to take advantage of that by going to areas that have the rules that they like. Now, that's not always the case with certain kinds of benefits that you then try to bring back into the first state. And I could see some states trying to preempt that kind of travel to a state that provides more access to abortion. I can see states trying to impose laws that would limit that, but generally speaking, if you want to take advantage of a different state's law, you can.
Dr. Moreland, let me ask about the next case. The court has also agreed to hear a challenge to New York's gun licensing requirement for carrying a gun in public. The issue at hand is whether someone under the Second Amendment can carry a gun in public without being licensed, as New York requires. So tell us a little bit about this case.
This is a case about, as you say, the concealed carry permitting process in New York State, which requires that in order to get such a permit, you have to show cause. And this is adjudicated then by a state official. And these were people who were bringing this claim who were denied this permit. So it's the case that follows on a case that was decided now 13 years ago, District of Columbia versus Heller, that recognized that there is in the Second Amendment an individual right to bear arms. But the court, other than a case that decided a few years later about whether that applied to states and local governments, the court hasn't weighed in since then on sort of what's the scope of that Second Amendment right to bear arms, and how does it play out in the context of carry permits. So I think that one of the issues here that's important is that there is this discretion in the New York process that I think is what's going to be a problem for the state here, that it vests a lot of kind of unfettered discretion in the ability of state officials to decide what counts as an adequate or inadequate reason for someone to be able to carry a gun for self-defense outside the home. And so if I had to prognosticate, and this is always a dangerous thing to do, I don't think it's going to be a broad opinion that there is an absolute constitutional right to conceal carry outside the home, but that instead the way in which these kinds of state provisions operate, which erect a lot of hurdles and kind of sort of difficulties logistically for people to get concealed carry permits, that the court will say that the state has to be more kind of deferential, more sort of liberal in allowing concealed carry permitting. And I suspect that's where it will come out. But it is the latest turn in this now, as I say, 13 years on from D.C. versus Heller, the latest turn in the question about what's the scope of the Second Amendment right to bear arms.
Yeah, Heller was a major case because it was one of the first, or you know, I remember at the time, being described as being the definitive decision on the Second Amendment. Now, whether it actually is or not, but you know, based on that, Professor Domino, how do you see the case?
I see Heller as establishing that the constitutional right to keep and bear arms applies to allow people to keep a gun in their homes. And this case is about whether people have the right to bear arms outside of their homes. So the what New York is basically tried to do is to say that you can keep your gun in your house, but you can't bring it out of your house unless you have some kind of special reason to have a gun with you. And as Professor Moreland says, there's a considerable amount of discretion in allowing the officials to determine what is good enough to constitute that special reason. I think that, again, some of the justices have already indicated a willingness to accept the claims of Second Amendment-based claims by individuals and associations such as the New York Rifle and Pistol Association that's bringing this case. Now Justice Kavanaugh was a judge on the District of Columbia case when it was at the lower court. He indicated in that case a pro Second Amendment rights view. And so I agree with Professor Moreland that New York is going to have an uphill battle defending this law. But it is a harder claim for the challengers than Heller was. And the difference is this, that in Heller, the District of Columbia law was an extreme outlier, both at the time the case was decided and historically, that there were just very few American laws that said you can't have a gun, period. The New York law, by contrast, restricts the ability to carry a concealed gun. It also restricts the ability to carry a gun in an open kind of way. But there are far more examples of decisions that place restrictions on what people can do with guns outside of their home than what they can do with it inside their home. And so if this case does go in favor of the gun association, it would move the Heller decision further in that direction. It wouldn't simply be an application of that precedent.
Yeah, Heller, Washington, D.C., and Chicago both had laws that banned gun possession with, you know, a lot of restrictions. But Professor DiMino, the Second Amendment seems to have more gray areas than anything, any other part. Am I being accurate when I say that? Because there's so many different interpretations. I mean, as you said, that there have been courts that have made restrictions on gun ownership and what type of weapons can be owned, that kind of thing. Is it accurate to say there's been more confusion, more gray areas in the Second Amendment than any other in the Constitution?
I don't think so. If I had to pick one, I would say the Fourth Amendment's ban on unreasonable searches and seizures seems to lead to hundreds of interesting questions about what's an unreasonable seizure every year. But certainly there is a lot of gray area in the Second Amendment, doctrine, because the Supreme Court has decided so few cases that prior to Heller in 2008, there really wasn't much of a decision on gun rights since the 30s. And post-Heller, there's only been one. And so whenever you have so few Supreme Court cases, you're not going to have the doctrine developed to a level of detail like it would be if the Supreme Court was hearing cases every year and giving more and more context to what they thought the law in this area had to be.
Professor Moreland, I saw you smile when Professor DiMino said Fourth Amendment search and seizure. You agree?
I mean, I think the question of what's the area of the Constitution where there's the most kind of uncertainty and doubt is a very competitive one. There's a lot of gray area in a lot of these areas. I do think that the Second Amendment it's interesting, as Professor DiMino says, the Supreme Court just hasn't weighed in that often. Really, Heller was this watershed case in 2008. And since then, the lower courts have generally speaking upheld all kinds of restrictions because the Supreme Court didn't really say in Heller, absent a total ban on gun ownership, what other kinds of restrictions could states and local governments or the federal government, for that matter, impose. And so for the most part, the lower courts have kind of let the government get away with all kinds of different sorts of restrictions. And that's what had caused gun rights advocates to be kind of going to the Supreme Court saying, you know, give us some more guidance about, you know, what kinds of limits are on the government's ability to do that. And so I think this this was the issue that I think had been out there for a while. You know, what about the concealed carry permitting process, especially in those states that are very restrictive about it, that, as I said, have all kinds of discretion baked in and allowed officials to make these decisions without much guidance. And so I think that's where you'll see the Supreme Court say, you can't do that. You have to be a little more permissive than that. And then we'll, again, kind of see how the lower courts resolve all kinds of challenges about, you know, what kinds of weapons can be restricted, what are the conditions under which they can be restricted, and so on.
Mm-hmm. We had a caller who weighed in, a caller from South Renovo, who said that expansion of weapons is not for the greater good. Dr. Borland, reason I bring that up is that the court is not deciding what is for the greater good, correct?
Well, I mean, it's a hard question, and depends what you mean. But I think, you know, they're interpreting the provisions of constitutional rights, and there are lots of ways in which the right to freedom of speech or the restrictions that Professor Domino mentioned earlier on the government's ability to conduct searches and seizures, in which constitutional rights stand in the way of government action of various kinds. And the Second Amendment, I think certainly this is the view on the part of gun rights advocates, is that the Second Amendment right to bear arms shouldn't be treated as a kind of poor cousin of other constitutional rights. It's right there in the text. Heller is a pretty authoritative interpretation of what it means. But again, how it plays out in particular contexts is yet to be seen. But I do think that it's similar to other kinds of constitutional protections that we have. And if, you know, to undo it would require a constitutional amendment. Mm.
The reason I mentioned confusion, because those are the kind of cases that do get a lot of attention. But what has created confusion over the years is that part in the Second Amendment about militias. And that's the part that, you know, people and courts have had trouble with. Okay, you know, we were talking about a different time in 1787. We only have a minute or so left. I want to thank you very much for being with us, both of you. One final case, Professor Domino, Boston Marathon's being run today. The Boston Marathon bomber reinstating an appeal to reinstate the death penalty. What's this one about?
The court has had to consider questions of when this two-part jurisprudence, the two-stage process for establishing the death penalty has been complied with. The Supreme Court has been very restrictive about when the death penalty can be imposed, but it is allowed for federal crimes as this one was charged, and the Supreme Court will continue placing more details about the limits under which that the death penalty can be imposed.
Okay, want to thank
cases involving terroristic type of crimes.
We are out of time. I want to thank both of you, Michael R. Domino, professor of law at Widener University Commonwealth Law School, Michael Moreland, professor of law and religion at Villanova University School of Law. Thank both of you for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.